Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, Answers for the Family is going to address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, or dealing with addictions. As I'm sure many of you expected to hear Alan's voice this morning, we are reminded of the reality of what he does when he's not on the air. As a licensed private investigator and crisis interventionist, he gets calls and has to respond quickly, be it locating a runaway, escorting a teen to a specialized program, or retrieving an abducted child. Now, I talked to Alan yesterday and learned that he's been asked to locate a runaway girl that's been exploited in a prostitution ring. So very, very dark stuff. And, you know, I've known Alan for 20 years and, you know, he's a detective before, he got into the, crisis intervention and transportation game. So there's no one better they can have on the case. And I wish him the best of success in rescuing this child and bringing her home. And we're looking forward to having him back next week. Now, today's show is really going to focus on adolescence, and we have two guests that are both licensed therapists, but I thought, and me being a licensed therapist, that gives us three, and we need a female side of this and another licensed therapist. So I am lucky to have in studio with me my dear friend Joelle Jacobson. Joelle is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She's a former school counselor and neurofeedback clinician, and aside from her private practice, she does work with me at the Betty Ford Outpatient Center in West LA. So, Joelle, welcome, and thank you for joining me.
I'm really looking forward to the show. Thank you for having me, Matt.
Yeah, I thought of no better person if we're talking about the adolescent game. You're also a mother, so...
I am, of two.
And teenagers, right?
Yes, they are.
So you're really entering the
I'm in it.
You're in it. You know, my private practice, which is no longer in existence, focused on adolescence. And today we're going to talk about outdoor wilderness programs and interventions really for your adolescents. And we're going to think a lot outside the box today. But there was a few things that for me were really vital in working with families. And if I could take of my 10 to 15 years in private practice, some of the most successful things that parents can do and kind of wrap them in five or six ideas, I'd like to share them with listeners just to give them at least a few skills that they could start to utilize before we bring our guests on. And the first thing that I think is really critical is to force our kids to think dialectically. And when we talk about dialectical thinking, what we're really talking about is that two opposites can be true at the same time. Ever since kids are young, they're taught that there's black and white things in this world. It's all or nothing thinking. Even as like a kid, you're watching a television show, the bad guy is all bad and the good guy is all good. In our political climate today, when we're sitting around a table with friends, there's this, you're either on this side or that side, and this side is all bad and our side is all good. And we're really struggling with kids to show them that the world is more complicated than that. And so I think as a parent and as a therapist, the more we can show kind of less rigid thinking with families, the better off we can be. So the first point I want to make, and Joelle, I guess I'll get your opinion on it, is this idea of thinking dialectically and modeling kind of dialectical ways to see things with families. The second thing I think is really critical is as parents and people who kind of deal with young adults, there's this idea of creating mood and controlling mood. I went with my wife last weekend and we saw this sad movie and we walked out and for 2 hours later, we were in this kind of somber, depressed mood. And we got in the car and we were driving to dinner and you could feel just kind of this sad mood kind of throughout the entire evening, actually. And I thought about it the next morning as I put on some music and I was kind of pumped up for the morning, that we control the mood of our that we live in and that we put our teenagers or our adolescents in. And so think about that when we're creating space. If you've got, you know, the news on when they come home and the news is all negative, that's going to help contribute to an overall negative mood for your kid. So first we talked about dialectical thinking, then we talked about mood. The other thing I think is really important is that we look at the parasympathetic nervous system. And that is, we have two systems. We have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And today's guests, when they come on, they're going to talk about a lot of different activities and outdoor things that really affect both the parasympathetic and sympathetic. A sympathetic nervous system is when you're in a dark alley and you hear footsteps behind you, your heart rate goes up, you start to sweat, your muscles tighten, and the brain studies are showing that when you're sympathetic dominant, you're using more of your old brain, not your kind of critical thinking area of the brain. And the other side of it is parasympathetic, and that's when you're more relaxed. So later today, when we're talking about organic gardening at this beautiful location, and you can picture adolescents sitting in the garden doing gardening, you could see them in a parasympathetic state. And again, the brain studies that we're looking at are showing that if children and adolescents are more parasympathetic, they're more able to use areas of their brain that has to do with creative thinking, impulsivity, anything, you know, that determines kind of higher order thinking. And so basically our goal is to create a more parasympathetic atmosphere and create more parasympathetic dominance within our adolescents.
Yes. And, you know, Matt, to speak to your point about the family environment, you know, as we know with addiction, 60% of it is genetic and 40% is environment. So in the home, if the parents are role modeling drinking, using drugs, and outside, you know, with their peers, they're seeing the same thing. They're certainly hearing it in songs that alcohol and drugs are glamorized, especially in rap music.
Mm-hmm.
But even as far as just going with the mood of the house, what you were talking about with the movies, you know, when there's mental illness in the house, if there's depression, anxiety is learned behavior. Depression, you know, again, genetic as well. And it's really important for parents to try to separate what's going on with them personally and focus on how that would be affecting the children, to keep that behind closed doors, because it certainly does affect the children and how they behave. So when you have a child who is, you know, quote unquote, out of control, you know, there's certainly something going on in the house that may be creating that sort of behavior with the child. And so much of what happens with children and adolescents are because of what the parents are doing or not doing.
That's brilliant.
And it's important for, you know, the parents to, you know, really get educated on that and take responsibility in order to help their child. Because when the parents bring in their children, as, you know, you and I talking about in our private practice, you know, they bring the child in, which is called the identified patient. When you start speaking with the families, you see that, oh, wait, it's actually what the parents are doing or not doing. So it's really important that the entire family unit is involved in the health of the child and getting that child better, and the entire family getting healthy.
Yeah, when we bring the gentleman on from Pacific Quest, you know, they're going to talk about their family program, which is truly dynamic. And a lot of things you were saying, you know, is really transference and modeling. And I don't think we realize how much modeling and transference matters. I was driving here today, and I accidentally pulled in front of someone. I didn't mean to cut them off. And the guy pulls up next to me and he extends a finger. I think you know which one. And then all of a sudden I felt a lot of anger inside me. And obviously he was angry at me, and anger gets transferred. And so all of a sudden I felt anger inside. And so we don't realize the impact that transference is in modeling and all these other things. So really quickly, just to sum up, the other thing about the parasympathetic thing is, you know, if we're in a relaxed state and our kids are not, we're not going to be able to communicate either with them. So if I'm picking up my daughter from school today and she's running to the car and she gets in the car, I ask her the dumbest question every parent asks their kid: how was your day? And she answers the same way every single kid in the world does: fine.
Right. On three. fine.
Exactly. because I'm parasympathetic and relaxed, but she's coming in a sympathetic state. So again, harping on that, trying to create a parasympathetic atmosphere. I talked briefly about mood. I talked about dialectical thinking. A couple other really short notes is, you know, you had mentioned happiness. And the studies show that we get happier as we get older, which is good. But then there's the other side of happiness where it shows 50% of our happiness we're kind of given. You know, it's kind of a genetic factor. And only about 40% we can control with activities. So one of the activities that, you know, Martin Seligman, the old president of the APA, and he wrote a book called Learn Optimism. One of the things that he harps on, and a lot of other scientists in the field of happiness harp on, is this idea of gratitude and doing gratitude studies and making sure that, you know, you're saying three or four times a day the things that, you know, make you happy and that you're grateful for. So think about that. Think about, again, the other stuff I discussed. And then one more thing, one of my famous favorite studies was a Duke's exercise study. 2004, they took 50 individuals. And they split them into two groups. And both groups, there's 25 in one group and 25 in another, both groups met clinical criteria for depression using a Beck's Depression Inventory. All 50 of the participants were given therapy each day. This was a four-week study done at Duke University. So all 50 of them get individual therapy. And 25 of them are asked to walk 30 minutes twice a day. So they go for a walk in the morning and a walk in the evening. Well, after the 4 weeks, they gave them the Beck's Depression Inventory again, and 23 of the 25 that did the walking reported less depression than the other group. So there's a lot of science talk in there, but what that tells us basically is moving is good. It helps mood, and it's critical for any adolescent or young adult. So I've yapped, and I'm sorry if that was too much for the listeners, but really the best part of our show, Answers to the Family, is bringing on excellent guests, and we've got two great ones today to talk about a wonderful program. So, Joelle?
Yes, we are so happy to introduce the people who are working at Pacific Quest, and I will first introduce Dr. John Souza, Jr. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a clinical fellow of the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, AMFT, who specializes in working with at-risk adolescents and their families. He's originally from Oahu, Hawaii, and raised on the mainland. Lucky guy. Dr. Souza completed his Bachelor of Science in Business Administration with a minor in Industrial Organizational Psychology at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul, Minnesota. And he went on to earn his Master's of Arts and Doctorate in Marriage and Family Therapy with a concentration in Addictions in Psychopharmacology from the Minnesota School of Professional Psychology at Argosy University in Twin Cities. We also have Mr. Mike Sullivan with us. He is a licensed mental health counselor with over 10 years of experience working with youth and families. His fascination with the wild and natural environment led him to pursue a career in wilderness therapy. Working for a therapeutic wilderness program in Idaho, Mike developed a sincere passion for working with adolescents and young adults, where he honed his interpersonal skills and nurtured his ability to connect with teens. Inspired by the power of experiential therapy in the desert of Idaho, Mike went on to earn his master's in psychology at Seattle University in 2009. So thank you both so much for being here. And I also want to give a little shout out to Minnesota, where Hazelden is, which Matt and I work for, Hazelden Betty Ford. So we'd love to hear about Minnesota. So please tell us a little bit about Pacific Quest.
Well, I'll dive in first. And this is Mike Sullivan. And thanks, Joelle and Matt, for having us on the show. And I guess I'll just work to set the stage, really, because, Matt, you did a fantastic job of really diving into the neuropsychology right off the bat, right, which is what our program's founded on, right, in that one of the things that we help set the stage for in terms of students' growth, and we call our patients students because we're both a therapeutic program as well as an accredited school, but essentially We've created an environment such that we can take a bottom-up approach to dealing with their mental health issues, right? That by soothing the nervous system, right? Gives us that inroad to be able to access those higher parts of the brain, right? The more complex parts of the brain. We were site certified in something called the neurosequential model of therapeutics several years ago. And since then, we've just put such an emphasis on this piece that, Matt, you're talking about, the soothing and having, you know, patterned and rhythmic behavior of working in the garden and minimizing stressors, right? And basically creating this kind of petri dish, if you will, for our students to be able to slow down, regulate, and start to then open doors into new parts of themselves. So I just want to highlight that, you know, and I'll let John Souza speak to that as well. But essentially, Matt, you did a great job of highlighting, you know, we're an organic gardening program on the Big Island in Hawaii. And it's an outdoor, basically, model where we basically work with kids to unplug from technology. And by kids, I'm talking about adolescents and young adults, 18 to 24-year-olds, in terms of leaving behind their family system at home for a bit and coming out and having their own experience. And then the process of us weaving in the family back into their experience throughout the process and how we can then address the larger family system, which we all know is such a critical part of this work.
It's amazing. Absolutely. The way you just presented that, because our science, the field of therapy, is such a soft science, and I think that we lose a lot of respect because we haven't been able to, until recently, really empirically validate what we're saying and making it more of a hard science. And I think with the brain studies at scans at UCLA that are showing the advantages of a parasympathetic nervous system, that soothed, relaxed state, what you guys are doing, really, we can now show is literally effective, but also there's brain science to prove its efficacy. So we've really jumped back, you know, miles and miles ahead of where we were maybe even 10, 15 years ago in what you guys do. And I think that, you know, that you guys basically, you know, you have the recipe here. And I think that the thing that came up for me as you were talking, Mike, is the unique challenge, of bringing them back into the family system. I would think that's the most rewarding and tricky part of this.
Yeah. Aloha, Joelle and Matt, and thank you for having us.
Thanks, John.
Aloha.
Aloha. So, you know, what really strikes me as I'm listening to everyone talk is that I'm sort of invoking the spirit of our horticultural therapy director, Travis Slagle. He would probably offer that what we're really doing is we're getting students back into the natural world. And I emphasize this so often with parents and caregivers when they come to visit the island for family program is, you know, we talk about that this is about getting back into the analog of the world. When we're inundated with the binary or the digital of the culture, and that it's a tough shift to go into the analog, and it's a tough shift to go back into the binary or the digital from the analog.
John, can I ask you a question? What's the when? Because I can't imagine a young adult going from this phone instant culture to coming there on the island and all of a sudden having to put up your phone. What do you see this giant shift in them in the first 24, 48 hours, or when's the big shift? Like, what do you kind of see in general?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and it's true. So what we do is, you know, we really use the garden, our experiences with the natural systems, to teach us about what we experience in our human systems, because we're all part of natural systems. And so we'll often see the shock. You know, if you imagine transplanting a plant from one pot to another, you're going to see a shock. You're going to see some degradation in the plant itself. It might start to, the leaves might start to wither, the flowers might start to fall apart, the stem might droop, and what's happening is that it's redirecting all of its energy into the root system to reestablish its roots. And so that's what we see in the students that come to visit. They've left their old environment. We've initiated what we call in family systems theory a second order change. It's a fundamental a structural shift, and yeah, naturally they go into that state of shock. But what we start to cultivate is everyone's heard of post-traumatic stress disorder, right? PTSD. But what's often not talked about or is obscured and that we talk about in gardening is PTG, or post-traumatic growth. And that kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Matt, with the parasympathetic. We really start to activate that system where we're paying attention to, through that neurosequential model of therapeutics, the regulation that's required to reestablish that root system. We have to start at that base level. And then from the bottom up, we start to work through the regulate. And then we start to work on the relating through social systems and social relationships. And then we can get into the reasoning, that neocortex, where we can start to reflect and reason on what's going on.
That's really,
as far as the timing of that, it ranges. But I'm sure if Dr. Britta, who's our medical director, was here, she would say it's probably around 4 to 6 weeks that we really start to see a student really work through all that detoxing, both from the physiological effects of whatever they were eating, like inflammation type of diet, where we offer more of an anti-inflammatory diet, and then from the cognitive and the social, where maybe they were inundated with poor sleep hygiene, or they were gaming, or in some other addictive type of patterns with unhealthy things like that, or socially they were in some not so healthy relationships, or the inverse, which is they weren't having any relationships. And it's really around that 4 to 6 week mark that we start to see them really start to benefit from being here.
Thank you. That's a really interesting description, especially the post-traumatic growth. I'm sure not a lot of people know about that. I have another question. The misperception is that when a child turns 18, that they are to act like an adult because they're legally an adult. But as many of us know, the executive functioning part of the brain isn't fully formed until age 26, so their decision-making skills are still of an adolescent. How do you help the young adults with better decision-making?
Joelle, I'll chime in on that one first. I think adolescents, while certainly there's studies that show that that brains are not finish fully forming until age 26. I think a lot more studies are coming out that even are pushing that age further and further back towards 30. But essentially, socially as well, we're seeing a kind of cultural shift where adolescence is extending beyond 18, right? Where with current millennials and whatnot, there's kids are leaving home at a later age, and there's much different drives and motivation towards independence and independent living. But I think one of the pieces that, to speak to your question about how do you start to instill those aspects of, increasing the executive functioning starts with this bottom-up approach that we're talking about, right, of simplifying their environment and then slowly building the skill set, right, of starting to add in and titrate in more and more responsibility, right, and chunk down tasks into manageable steps so that then once the young adults have this kind of basically skill set to operate from, right, of how to prioritize and organize and start to like strengthen those muscles, if you will, through practice. There's also this, parallel experience of self-confidence, right, where as you experience yourself being successful in different arenas and you're placed in this kind of social environment that's a positive peer culture and a milieu that promotes that self-awareness and confidence, but then the kids essentially start to trust themselves more and have a bigger kind of foundation to step from in terms of making those decisions. So that's one of the key components I see in terms of building those executive functioning muscles and then, at the same time, having the confidence to do it.
Thank you for explaining
that. If I could add to that, I think also the benefit of being in the garden, the horticulture therapy that we employ really allows for a unique experience with the natural cycles, the natural rhythms of life, including death, which is something that is often obscured in our general U.S. culture. You know, there's a real emphasis on youth and vitality and happiness, but oftentimes things like aging and death are obscured, and we don't get to see a whole lot of that. But in the garden, and I think what it's unique about it, say, from something like equine therapy, not to, you know, minimize that work, because I have many therapist friends who are equine therapists, and it's awesome. But we get to have a student come in and engage with the garden and make mistakes and potentially kill a plant, or if they're having a big emotional outward expression, they want to tear some plants out of the bed, they can do that. And then they can sit with that and reflect on it. And they start to really see themselves in the garden. They start to see how their developmental process is reflected in the garden. And so they can go from planting the seed and learning to nurture that, and in turn, they're nurturing something inside of themselves, to watching that seed grow into a plant, and then possibly going to the place where they have to harvest it and compost it, and then to see how that thing that seemed to not have any purpose anymore now becomes useful soil over the course of a number of weeks. So really seeing their own relationships with themselves and with others reflected in the garden is a huge benefit, and improves that ability to decision make and to tap into their own intuition about what is helpful in this life, something that is genetically encoded in us because we co-developed with all these other systems that we interface with.
As you talk, you know, it's just such a beautiful analogy of the garden and life. And I think that what you're really bringing to the surface is the difference between your program and a, quote, traditional wilderness program. And we're going to take a break. But when we get back, I want to talk about that, because there's a lot of empirical evidence of the effectiveness of wilderness therapy. But I want to talk about the differences of your program and also some of the outcome studies you guys are doing. So, again, we are with from Pacific Quest, Dr. John Souza and Mike Sullivan. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Welcome back to Answers for the Family. This is Dr. Matt Polacek, your co-host, and we are joined by Dr. John Souza and Mike Sullivan of Pacific Quest. Gentlemen, I had mentioned before we had left that your program is very different than a traditional wilderness program. Will you talk a little bit about what makes your program different? And then also, you know, both of them have great outcomes, but I'm sure you've got some feelings on the matter. So I'll give you the floor.
Sure. Thank you, Matt. And I'll start out again. And I think John does a great job at filling in and expanding on some things I talk about as well. One thing I'd say that really sets us apart in terms of being an outdoor model and not a wilderness model per se, is that, you know, we're a base camp model, right? In that our kids sleep in beds every night and they have the same environment to return to day in and day out. Now, we talk a lot about how, you know, soothing the nervous system is an important foundational part of therapy. And this aspect of not roaming around a desert or a mountain environment and not being on a constant adventure can actually help soothe and give routine and stability and consistency to regulating that nervous system. So I think our kids really thrive from having routine and predictability in their day to day. Now, beyond that, of course, I can just say, having spent so many years, on the slopes of the volcano in Hawaii, the fertile soils, the tropical landscape, the garden metaphors that are just abounding really are just a growth promoting climate. So I'll start in and say that's one aspect two aspects that I see that really set us apart in terms of the work we do. Now, I'll say one more third one here John mentioned our medical director, Dr. Britta Zimmer, right? And having collaborated with her for so many years, she's really helped infuse this really holistic approach to therapy as well, where, as the kids are acclimating to Pacific Quest, right? One of the first things they're learning about are the five pillars of health, right? The naturopathic tenets that really help bring their bodies and minds back online to start with. So we are emphasizing the importance of nutrition and daily exercise and sleep and hydration and breathing, right? We're giving them these key critical components to, basically inroads they have to their mental health and building a more kind of stable baseline from which to operate from. So that's another kind of key thing is I've networked with a lot of colleagues at different conferences in the kind of larger wilderness therapy field. And one thing that I come back to every time is just how great our, naturopathic and holistic approach is.
So I have a question. Because the parents' understanding of what role they've played in their child decompensating is imperative to their child getting better, how do you break through their denial of the role they played, and how closely do you work with the families? Because you are in Hawaii and the families may not be local. So how do you work with the family system in order to end up with a positive outcome and long-term recovery as far as mental health stability or as far as substance use? How do you work with the families to ensure that when the child discharges, that they will be in a healthy situation when they return back to their home?
I can try to field that one, Mike. I think it's a really important question. How do we work with the families? And I'm sure you know, Joelle, as a marriage and family therapist, that one of the biggest challenges when you have an identified patient, that's usually the person who has the least amount of voice or power in the family, to become a systemic issue and not just an individual issue. But I really do subscribe to a both-and approach as opposed to an either-or approach, which means that there's an individual who has culpability and responsibility, and it's a systemic issue as well, meaning that it's the unique chemical emergent property, if you will, of all those people coming together to create some kind of family dynamic that could over time become what we consider, not pathological, but problematic. So I think it's really holding that both and I think, Matt, you referred to it earlier, that dialectical thinking. We're talking about how do we hold multiple truths simultaneously. So I really, at the beginning, when families come to Pacific Quest, we start immediately working with them through telephone calls and letter writing. And it's really giving students and families a chance to just have a break from each other so that they can take some opportunity to look at themselves and notice what's different for them when they're not interacting and being reactive with each other. Then after about 6 or so weeks, when the caregivers will come to the island family program, that's when we get to see what happens with each group, with the student and with the parents, when they come back together that didn't happen before, and then reflect that back to them, not in a judgmental way, but in a spirit of cooperation and investigation. We want to know what was different for you. What did you like about yourself before you got back together? And what are you noticing now that you'd like to change moving forward? So we do subscribe to a rites of passage model as well. And so we think of this in three categories of severance, threshold, and incorporation. And oftentimes we're talking with the families about, so what is your old story together as a family? And then we give them this opportunity during family program to cross the threshold and explore your family timeline together, explore your family history. What did you like? What do you want to hold on to? What do you want to get rid of? And then to start to incorporate that. Let's start to put into practice the things that you learned about yourself. So it really moves away from a divisive right, wrong, good, bad, and more into a more natural systems analog approach of both and. There's diversity and truth. There's diversity in nature, and that really leads to a healthier, more resilient ecology. So that's true for families as well.
You know, and I know, and coming to understand the program, there's letters and there's calls and there's video conferences and in person with family members. And one of the things I really like is this idea of corrective relational experiences, which is actually just what you're touching on, correct?
Absolutely.
In the,
so one of the main challenges is how to support differentiation in a family, which is how do you remain separate yet connected? But then how do you also have congruence as an individual? How do you express what's really on your heart and your mind with someone else, yet maintain a relationship? And I think those are the two key elements of having a corrective relational experience when families are in family program.
That was a very loaded statement, and I hope listeners understood what you were saying, because it's brilliant, the first part of that to me, of this idea of an independent person and then someone who's part of a family. Will you kind of expand on that, just because I think it's really important?
Right. So if you think of a cell, and it goes through the process of mitosis, cell division, yet it remains part of a larger body. And we could think of our own human bodies as an example of this. That's exactly what's happening in a family system, where the young adult is, and I'm speaking about young adults because that's what I mainly work with at PQ. They are separating from their families of origin, yet at the same time, and is often true for a huge number of emerging adults, as we call them, in the U.S. population, they're still financially dependent on their parents, or they're living at home, or they're really emotionally dependent on them. So they're still connected to them. And of course, the dominant discourse in the U.S. is that the ultimate goal is individuation, meaning that you have separated from your family and you're no longer dependent on them. But the reality is not that. And I think one of the challenges and one of the reasons that I think it's so important to do family therapy with emerging adults and their families is that discrepancy right there, that we have this ideal in mind of what we should be doing within the ages of 18 to 25, yet the reality of the majority is different.
Excellent. And Joelle just wrote down, she had a caller, and you wrote down what they asked, right? You have it?
Yes. We had a caller, a local caller actually from Los Angeles. This is what she wrote. My cousin's daughter, 15, is a cutter, very rebellious, and has been in and out of local programs for the past year. Nothing seems to be making a difference. They are at their wit's end, and I keep telling them that sending her to a program out of state would be a good next step. Christy, the daughter, says that she will run away if she is forced to do this, but maybe a program in Hawaii might not be rejected so quickly. Can you describe how you would communicate with a parent who is fearful of their child running away or becoming violent? Well, that's actually right, because it's not a locked facility. So how do you handle the runners?
Wow, that's a great question. Okay, I'll take a stab at this one. You know, I mean, so much of what us therapists do at Pacific Quest, right, while we've emphasized, you know, much about how we work with the identified patients, is we try to support the parents as much as we can in this process as well, right? As when we remove that identified patient from the system, the anxiety oftentimes goes up, right? And that absolutely is a process we enter into from the start, as this person is asking, right? Which is, there's already fears and concerns looming, right? The family's already in crisis with the way that, you know, this child's behaviors are, you know, really problematic and scary. So, you know, I say our really relational approach, certainly being in Hawaii helps win the kids over. But, you know, we take a very nurturing approach, right? Where we meet the kids where they're at in the first week or so of the program, right? Where we're not there to tell them what to do or how to be. We set basic boundaries and basic expectations, and we look for them to kind of to hook their curiosity. Now, certainly they understand that, you know, we have certified and trained frontline staff who, if a child is going to run away, we'll have to put them into a restraint. But that is very, very seldom. We certainly uphold safety as a number one kind of priority. But essentially, we really work with the kids to help them to settle in. And we work with parents, you know, over the phone to understand that so much of their concerns and, you know, help them to basically, you know, manage anxiety and to kind of take care of themselves in this process is important as well. So I hope that kind of speaks to the listener's question, and certainly we'll share at the end our main phone line and our website where we could certainly get into the specifics really about how we manage that. But, you know, it's really important to us to just really care for the individual kids on, and meet them where they're at with each one.
Thank you for that. I actually have another caller from Boston, and this is the question. I've always thought of wilderness programs as punitive. Mental illness and substance use disorders are no fault of the adolescent. So can you explain how that is for the self-esteem of the adolescent to be sent to a wilderness program as opposed to a primary mental health or dual diagnosis program?
That's a really good question. I don't know that I'd have a really good answer for it. What I can offer, though, what comes to my mind first is this harkens back to, I think, the stigma of mental health treatment overall. That's something that we've been working through for you know, 50 plus years, maybe even longer. I know that we all have this implicit bias towards mental health, and some of the studies at Harvard around are pretty poignant in their results, pointing to that, you know, we often think of people with a mental illness as being violent or dangerous, and then that's really not the reality, statistically speaking. So first of all, I think I would bring into question, you know, what is mental illness? And then, you know, what are the benefits of looking at it in a different way? And if we can look at our society as being full of signs, indicators that there's something amiss, right? We're all struggling right now with this, you know, we've got the political climate that's going on. It seems to be very divisive. We have economic issues. We've got globally, you know, the threats of things like nuclear war, the idea of possible climate change and what's our culpability and all of that. There's a lot going on. And so I bring it back down to the garden. How do we adapt to what's going on around us? And most of us develop ways of adapting that get us through for a time. And then as our life phase changes, those old ways of adapting become less adaptable, less functional. So I guess that's the first thing that comes to my mind, is how do we question the idea of mental illness?
Thank you for that answer.
Bring it back to center.
No. I think that you know, there's many wilderness programs, and how do you know which program is going to be safe for your child and which is going to be more of a militant approach? And I think that was kind of what the caller was looking for. There is actually a similar question from another caller from Tennessee. And this question is, when is a wilderness program indicated as opposed to rehab? So I guess what would be the difference between those two programs?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know which type of program to send your child to?
Yeah. The other thing that's coming into my mind is I'm remembering our clinical director, Dr. Lorraine Friedel. And so I'd like to invoke her spirit a little bit, because I'm sure she would say something to the effect of, you know, a wilderness typically is for those who are externalizing behavior. You know, they're more of the what we consider from a mental health diagnosis perspective, oppositional defiance, you know, conduct disorder type of student. Right. Whereas what we are, Pacific Quest, I'd say, is more of an outdoor behavioral health care model. And so that's more for the internalizers, people who are struggling with anxiety or internalized anger, which comes out as depression.
I love that.
Those who isolate, those kinds of issues.
You know, one of Alan and my favorite thing to do when we get towards the end of any show is to talk about, again, I talked earlier about gratitude, but I like to share some of our favorite stories and hear some of the best stories from our guests. And so I'm wondering, you know, John or Mike, if you've got a story of a student that you had or some part of your program that you could share with us.
Yeah, I'll chime in on that one. I think, you know, one of the things that comes to my mind in terms of working with a student, you know, he's gone on to start community gardens at schools and in parks, and really just like a steward of kind of mental health and his own personal growth. But essentially he came to PQ with the lowest self-confidence, you know, numbing and avoiding through using marijuana and retreating to his bedroom. You know, he was just in such a shut down state, right? And literally, as John kind of talked about in his metaphor of the plant, watching him first come to PQ and recoil, right, in his first week or so, and start to kind of remain retreated and closed off. And then he started to try some new aspects in the garden, and his body came online, and we, you know, kind of revamped his nervous system. I watched this young man through the process, and I was his therapist, so I got to, you know, really witness, you know, basically his increase in his coping skills, his self-awareness, his confidence, and watch him really blossom through the process. And so this was a neat kid. To talk about the family system and the way I was able to work with his parents at the same time to identify the roles that they played in the family. And Joelle, you talked about, you know, a lot of parents come into this process and they don't necessarily, they aren't aware of the kind of vectors at play within the family system and the roles that, you know, they played in that system. So in their process of recognizing how their choices and their behaviors impacted the others, as well as even the younger sibling in this process as well, they made changes, right, in their communication patterns and in the way that they became less reactive and others more assertive. And, you know, we basically, you know, bred some life into this kind of system and, you know, restructured it such that, you know, he went on to do great things. And right now is away at college and doing fantastically. So, you know, that's a little bit, and I'm watching our timeline here as well. That's a little bit of a success story and one that comes to mind in terms of an experience of a young man who's, you know, out living, you know, his intent statement and utilize this rite of passage.
That doesn't surprise me given the program you guys have. And I really love the garden metaphor. I'm sure everyone listening does, and therapists across our great country do. It's just a wonderful program. And I think it's important that it is differentiated from another wilderness program because of its unique. It's a completely different program. But at any rate, Pacific Quest, I'm excited to have you guys on. Will you let us know briefly, the listeners, what's the best way to reach you guys?
Absolutely. So the best way to reach us is you can learn the most about us online at our website at pacificquest.org. And then you're absolutely welcome to call us and direct more individualized questions to our admissions line, which is 808-937-5806. And I'll repeat that just one more time for listeners. 808-937-5806.
Dr. Souza, Mr. Sullivan, such a pleasure to have you. I want to thank Joelle for joining me. I know you're very busy, and so I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
And also, looking forward to Alan's wonderful return next week. And speaking of, please make sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next week when we are joined by Rocky Rosen, founder of The Cigarette Whisperer, who will discuss how quitting smoking has never been easier. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or subscribe to our shows through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or Vimeo. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and be greatly appreciated. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word. Thank you all for listening to Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.